of shooting that would occur in, you know, like a big county like L.A. or Sacramento by saying they don't arrest the officer every time they have an officer-involved shooting.
But that's it. That's when that police officer shoots someone in the capacity of his duty as a police officer.
That's correct.
Not as a private citizen in his father's backyard.
That's correct. I understand what you're saying, but I'm trying, in some respects, to play devil's advocate here.
Okay.
District Attorney Mike Ferguson speaking with correspondent Mike Thornton. Listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts, or if you want to make a comment or suggestion for future programs, that's 800-529-5736. Young people, especially young people of color, are often at risk of police harassment, and in some cases, violence. That risk is sometimes exacerbated when a youth is affiliated with a gang or a group of individuals who could be mistaken for a gang. That's one of the reasons why two rival gangs in Southern California, the Crips and Bloods, signed an historic truce in 1992. Correspondent Christian Parenti spoke with Dwayne Holmes, a former gang leader who was instrumental in forging the peace agreement. According to many witnesses, Holmes was framed for a $10 robbery because of his involvement with the truce. Despite the intervention of Congresswoman Maxine Waters, then presidential candidate Jerry Brown, State Senator Tom Hayden, and author Mike Davis, Holmes was sentenced to 7 years in prison. He was released after 3.5 years. Holmes told Parenti that the police framed him because a ceasefire between the notorious street gangs meant the groups were more organized to challenge police brutality, which was running rampant in the Watts housing projects.
There were incidents that was taking place in at least three of the four housing projects that's located in this this kind of like small geographical area in the Watts community, in the Imperial Courts housing projects in which I lived. My cousin Henry Pico had been murdered by the Los Angeles Police Department. In the Jordan Down housing projects, there was an incident where the residents had got into a physical brawl with law enforcement behind some unlawful treatment of the residents inside of the housing projects. In the Nickerson Garden, there were a confrontation that I think resulted in some type of gun battle between law enforcement and the residents over there as a result of some other type of unlawful acts that was being perpetrated by the Los Angeles Police Department against the residents in the housing project. In an attempt to try to consolidate the different groups that had sprung up in these different housing projects during that time to address those issues. In my housing projects, we had the Henry Pico Justice Committee that had been formed to bring some attention to police abuse and police misconduct. In the Nickerson Gardens, they had developed a community-like group of concerned citizens. In the Jordan Downs, there was an attempt by some individuals through AmeriCan and other groups to also foster some type of sense of dialogue around the issue of police misconduct and police abuse. In the wake of that, and understanding that in order for these groups of concerned citizens to get together and to begin to figure out a strategy to address this whole issue, there needed to be a clearance. There needed to be some type of agreement amongst the aggressive elements in these different communities, which is identified as gangs, for a better word. There needs to be some type of agreement with them established so that individuals like myself, who was a member of the Imperial Courts gang, the PJ Watts Crips, and individuals like Daoud Sherrells, who was a member of the Grape Street Watts Baby Lokes, and individuals like BJ and Hankner, who were from the Nickerson Garden Bounty Hunters, there needed to be an agreement with these gangs that these individuals represented in order for these individuals to come over into this neighborhood and to begin to participate in the discussion about how to go about addressing this urgent need to deal with law enforcement, or to actually address the issue of police abuse.
So now people are fairly familiar with what happened once there was a truce. It was signed and solidified right before the riots, but then what happened to you? Could you just briefly tell us about the trouble with the police?
Well, my trouble with the police began before the inception of the truce and everything. I think that the signing of this declaration of peace, and me being an individual who had an extensive record, criminal record, and gang activity, etc., spearheading this whole movement in terms of trying to consolidate these different aggressive elements in the community, placed me at the forefront of the police's agenda in terms of whom was a threat and whom we needed to isolate in order to dismantle this whole movement, because that's eventually what the ceasefire agreement was turning into. Law enforcement, however, viewed that as a threat, and understandably so. We were talking about declaring a ceasefire amongst ourselves. No one talked about getting at the police, but no one talked about making a pact or a truce, forming a truce with law enforcement. I think that law enforcement saw that as, we were coming together and we were talking about setting aside our differences, but the fact that we wasn't talking about setting aside our differences with law enforcement made them the primary target or focus of our anger and our rage. And I think that scared them more than anything else.
You ended up being framed, and you had numerous celebrities and politicians at your sentencing hearing, and but to no avail, because you ended up going to prison. And so when you got out, What was the situation on the street?
Truces were still in place, somewhat, which was good. You know, they were fragile, but they were there, which was good. But no one really had an idea of what the truces meant, what these ceasefire agreements really meant. The individuals who were spearheading and calling themselves leaders of this whole truce movement were self-seeking individuals who were in this for their own personal gains and didn't give a damn about the neighborhoods or the communities that they were professing to represent.
What was the role of the authorities in fostering sort of a false truce leadership?
The authorities, I think that they systematically weeded out individuals, you know, by taking individuals like myself whom they knew would never compromise with them, who they knew, you know, was on the other side of the fence from them, who were pushed out of the way. And then authorities, you know, again, strategically placed individuals like Tony Bogard and gave them credibility in terms of being these truce leaders and so forth. And, you know, and that's what essentially destroyed the movement. Individuals were targeted and gave opportunities, whereas the communities and the overall masses of people were left out of that opportunity, you know, I guess field or whatever, and you know, and they saw it and they felt it, you know what I'm saying? And they began to resent, you know, laying down their weapons and forming these peace pacts or whatever, you know. And they went back, and we witnessed this backlash from that. We witnessed individuals going back to their old familiar ways of doing things, you know, warring and robbing and stealing and killing and so forth, you know. And so now, when I'm out on the streets and you know, getting out and I'm talking to brothers about peace and, you know, about unity and about, you know, resolving their differences, and they say, man, been there, done that. You know what I'm saying? Man, been there, done that, homeboy. We didn't get nothing. You know what I'm saying?
Dwayne Holmes speaking with Christian Parenti. Holmes is currently a staff person for State Senator Tom Hayden.
The confrontation was not created by the police. The confrontation was created by the people who charge the police. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder. And we get the thing straight once and for all.
Some used to step cause they didn't know I worked. Others used to step cause they didn't know I hurt. Plaguing me with problems cause they thought I was a gangster. Gas like a tanker, no time for pranksters. I was split from the giddy up. They didn't give a fuck, so I didn't give a fuck. Hat to the back and my jeans were sagging. Hitting some freestyle, fronting and bragging. Minding my own biz when they wanna stop me. Looking for some donuts but they chose to pop me. Emailing a brother, should I say another word? Cause you know how this gold is getting served. ID, name and number. Love against the wall, cause we start no wonder. You got a lot of dollars in your pockets, one fucking bum. Hands on the wall and assume the position. Clubs start poking, I'm like, man, you must be joking. Just because I do some poking, big blunt smoking. It can happen to you, because it happened to me. Because these aren't the cops that you see on TV. To say my part, enabling me to explain how I was labeled from the start. I was feeling like Cupid trying to capture a heart, but an arrow's really stupid, so I made like a dart. Started to sprint, but I was stopped in my tracks. A couple of cops, they were right in a fight, right? I didn't try to fight as they grabbed me by my back. Cause cops can overreact, and I thought they might attack. But picture that, sweet. A criminal, I busted a rap because they obviously just didn't know. So here we go to make a long story shorter. Sway that game for the bread and the water. Then the order was to lay on the ground. Put your hands on your head, don't make a motherfucking sound. They breaking me down, but they still ain't found nothing. But next time around, I'm gonna give them something. They front, cause here's one blunt they missed. My fist was clenched around a big fat cliff. It can happen to you, cause it happened to me. And these aren't the cops that you see on TV.
Disorder.
there when I was made. Shit, dearly, she's got a brother in the pit. I'm the really pick the niggas on a pig type bit. Shit your fucking face, get off, bring it, lick it. Grab your ankles like Bojangles, I'll fucking kick ya. Verbally abuse is not conducive transition. Just a bunch of boys in blue can get used to the system of the rapists and murderers and the sons of Sam. But look at where I am, seeing Uncle Scam I am. Sick of my biggies, make me drop my fucking skibbies. Sick of being arrested when I haven't done diddly. Really, really, really with abuses in prison. No segregation but law, we'll check out this division. Head to the hoops, now head to the slammer. Head to the roundhouse, grab a sledgehammer. Arrested 4 times, but never found guilty. But these ain't the cops that you see on TV.
Scenes on television have only the highest praise for the police. They indeed have kept the right of minors to go to work open, and they've done it marvelously. Government. They are out to bring down the framework of law. That is what we have seen in this strike.
When the Supreme Court essentially struck down capital punishment in 1972, the majority cited evidence of racial bias. By 1976, the court concluded that equal justice could be applied in death penalty cases and overturned its 1972 decision. Since then, almost 380 inmates have been executed. Texas leads the country with 131 executions. The leading judge in the United States for death sentences is Albert Sabo in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. According to the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, Sabo has sentenced twice as many people to death as any other judge in the country, and 30 out of 32 of his death sentences have been against people of color. Sabo's most well-known case is that of Mumia Abu-Jamal, an award-winning broadcast journalist and former Black Panther. He was convicted of the 1981 fatal shooting of a Philadelphia police officer. Attorney Leonard Weinglass, Jamal's chief counsel, spoke about the case at a rally in San Francisco this past August.
Mumia was an activist broadcast journalist in the city of Philadelphia in the late 70s and early 80s, the leading critic of the police department, the only person who brought forward the truth about what happened to the Move 9 when they were wrongfully charged with the death of a police officer, and the man who was fingered by the mayor of the city, former police commissioner, who said to Mumia at a press conference, "Young man, someday you're going to be held accountable for what you're saying and writing." And what Mumia was saying and writing was documenting the brutality directed against the minority and the poor community of Philadelphia by that police department. Was his voice alone? No. For the first time in the history of the United States, the Department of Justice sued an entire police department, the police department of the city of Philadelphia, in 1979, using in that lawsuit the very accusations that Mumia made public on public radio, which was picked up and broadcast nationwide by NPR and Westinghouse. So it was no surprise that in 1981, the early morning hours of December 9th, when Mumia came upon a scene as he was working nights driving a cab, Mumia, who was the president of the Black Journalists Association of Philadelphia, had to drive a cab at night to support his family because his attacks on the police and the establishment were such that local radio stations began to drop his broadcasts. And he came upon a scene where his brother was being beaten on the street by a Philadelphia police officer. And he stopped his cab and he ran to the scene. All of the witnesses in his case agreed that this is what occurred, both the prosecution witnesses and the defense witnesses. It was the beating of Mumia's brother that brought him to that scene. The police officer's flashlight was found broken on the sidewalk, blood stains on the lens. Mumia's brother was located moments later with a gash over his eye where the flashlight struck him. And as Mumia ran to that scene, gunfire erupted. He was shot. The bullet pierced his chest, went through his lung, through his liver, and lodged in his lower back. He fell onto the sidewalk, where he was found in a pool of blood within 5 minutes by the arriving police. The officer who was engaged with his brother was also shot, once in the back and once between the eyes. He was found lying about 5 feet from Mumia. The two were picked up and rushed to the hospital. Both were operated on. The officer died. Mumia recovered and was charged with shooting the officer. I might say, and I could go on and on all night about the facts, but I just want to interject here how Mumia was brought to the hospital. The officers who brought him to the hospital testified, and they acknowledged that they had difficulty picking Mumia up. And when they went to put him in a van, they accidentally rammed his head into a pole. And then they said they lost the grip on him and dropped him on his face on the pavement while his arms were handcuffed behind him. And he was near faint from the injury. And then they got him to the hospital and they said they couldn't find a gurney or a stretcher or a bed in the hospital. So they dropped him on the floor. And he was found there when the surgeons came and brought into an operating room where he was operated on. And when he was returned to the recovery room, the nurse who came into the recovery room gave a statement saying that there were two police officers standing on the bag that was taking the fluids out of his body, forcing the fluids back up into his body. And she had to remove them. That night, at 4 o'clock in the morning, no fewer than 5 people told the police that they saw the shooter run away. These 5 people were not together. They were in different places on the street. One was up in a building overlooking the scene. The police never investigated that claim. despite the fact that all five have the shooter running away on the same side of the street in the same direction. Either five people were hallucinating about the same event, or the shooter did run away.
One eyewitness said that she saw Jamal shoot Officer Faulkner, and Jamal did have a gun with him.
But what was not presented to the jury was the fact in the autopsy report, the doctor who removed the bullet from the officer's brain, which was the fatal bullet, noted specifically in the report that the bullet was a .44 caliber bullet. Mumia's gun was a .38 caliber gun. You cannot shoot a .44 caliber bullet with a .38 caliber gun. Well, wasn't that persuasive? The answer is no, because the jury never heard that. Mumia's lawyer never read the autopsy report. And then the prosecution presented, as its final thrust against Mumia, a so-called confession that Mumia, a trained court reporter and journalist, blurted out for everyone to hear when he was laying on the floor in the hospital that he shot the officer and he hoped he died. And that testimony was produced by the officer's partner, plus a security guard who wanted to be a police officer, more than 2 months later. They remembered that Mumia had said that. But the officer who had arrested Mumia that night and who was with him gave an oral report which was recorded. And in that report, he said the male Negro made no comments. Well, wasn't that convincing? And the answer is no, because the jury never heard from that witness. When Mumia went to call that police officer, they said he was on vacation and unavailable. We found him, put him on the stand in 95, and he said, I was technically on vacation, but I was at home in the city of Philadelphia, 20 minutes from the courthouse, and I would have come if they had called me. Well, they didn't call him, but said he was unavailable. So they never heard from that witness. Well, the prosecution had what they said was a murder weapon. They had eyewitnesses. They had what they said was a confession. They had a jury that the prosecution removed 11 qualified African-Americans from that jury. In a city that's 49% at that time African-American, the jury was made up of 10 mainly elderly whites, which included one man who cared for his neighbor for 10 years, who was a Philadelphia police officer who had been shot while on duty, and another juror who was married to a Philadelphia police officer. And these jurors, not hearing a defense, not hearing from Mumia, hearing only the prosecution's version of the case, retired to deliberate, and they came back in 2 hours, and they asked the judge to be re-instructed on the law of manslaughter. Because, and I've talked to the jurors now, and they're thinking this was a fight on the street that escalated into gunfire. They didn't know who shot who first or exactly how it happened, but if Mumia was the shooter, there was no premeditation here. His brother was being beaten, and it was, after all, nothing more than manslaughter. Mumia would have been released 7 years ago if he had been convicted of manslaughter. Instead, the judge told the jurors, premeditation in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania can be found in the fraction of a second it takes to pull a trigger. And so the jury retired and came back with first-degree murder. Now the prosecutor faced a real problem. He wanted the death penalty, but this jury was thinking manslaughter. How do you get to the death penalty when you have a jury thinking manslaughter? And here, they reached back into their bag of tricks. And they pulled out something which the United States Supreme Court has since said is not to be permitted in any courtroom in the United States. That is one's political background in order to gain the death penalty. And what did they do about Mumia's political background? He was 28 years old at the time he was tried. When he was 16, he was a member of the Black Panther Party 12 years earlier. He was interviewed by a media representative after Fred Hampton was assassinated by the police in Chicago. And in response to questions, he told that media representative, quoting from Chairman Mao Zedong of the People's Republic of China, "Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun." And they played that quote to the jury, and the fact that Mumia was a member of the Black Panther Party, as if to show that somehow on this night, Mumia was exercising political power by using a gun. And that jury, within an hour, on the July 4th weekend, when they were asked to deliberate, brought back a verdict of death.
In every phase and facet of national life, there's a war being waged on America's poor. In social policy, poor mothers are targeted for criminal sanctions for acts, if committed by mothers of higher economic class, would merit treatment at the Betty Ford Center. In youth policy, governments hasten to close schools while building boot camps and prisons as their graduate schools. Xenophobic politicians hoist campaigns to the dark star of imprisonment for street beggars, further fattening the fortress economy. The only apparent solution to the scourge of homelessness is to build more and more prisons. In America's 90s, to be poor is not so much socioeconomic status as it is a serious character flaw, a defect of the spirit. Federal statistics tell a tale of loss and want so dreadful that Dickens, of A Tale of Two Cities fame, would cringe. Consider 7 million people homeless with less than $200 in monthly income. 37 million people, 14.5% of the nation's population, living below poverty levels. Of that number, 29% are African Americans, meaning over 10.6 million blacks living in poverty. Both wings of the ruling Republican Party try to outdo themselves in announcing new, ever more draconian measures to restrict, redress, restrain, and to eliminate the poor. One is reminded of the wry observation of French writer Anatole France: "The law, in its majestic equality, forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread." Already, U.S. manufacturers have fled to NAFTA-friendly Mexico, and only the Zapatista insurgency in Chiapas has slowed an emerging flood of Western capital. Outgunned in the industrial wars by Japan and Germany, the U.S. has embarked on a low-technology, low-skilled, high-employment scheme that exploits the poor, the stupid, and the slow via a boom in prison construction, America's sole growth industry. Increasingly, more and more Americans are guarding more and more American prisoners for more and more years, and this amidst the lowest crime rate in decades. No major political party has an answer to this social dilemma, short of cages and graves for the poor. The time is ripe for a new, brighter, life-affirming vision that liberates, not represses, the poor, who, after all, are the vast majority of this earth's people. Neither serpentine politics nor a sterile economic theory which treats them, people, as mere economic units offer much hope, for the very politicians they vote for spit in their faces while economists write them off as non-persons. It must come from the poor, a rebellion of the spirit that reaffirms their intrinsic human worth based upon who they are rather than what they possess. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
For more information about my case, racism, and the death penalty, and what you can do, contact Equal Justice USA at 301-699-0042.
Oh. Yeah, this is DeAndre from the October 22nd National Commission to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. He said hello to all our brothers and sisters in Santa Cruz. Police brutality must stop, and keep listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3. Thank you.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like a tape or a transcript of the show, or if you have comments or suggestions for future programs we'd like to hear from you, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. Nationwide, race is an overwhelming factor in determining who is sentenced to death and who is not, according to numerous academic and government studies. Over half of those on death row are people of color. Black men make up nearly 40% of all U.S. death row prisoners, although they account for only 6% of the U.S. population. And according to Equal Justice USA, an anti-death penalty organization, people of color are not committing more crimes punishable by death. For example, under the 1988 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, a cornerstone of the so-called war on drugs that expanded the death penalty for drug-related murders, 3/4 of those convicted by 1994 were white, but 29 of the 37 people charged under the law for capital crimes were black. 4 of the remaining 8 were Latino. Robert Bryan is a death penalty defense attorney and former chairman of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
A person of color who's charged with killing a white person is much more likely to be convicted and executed than a white person accused of killing a white person, or a white person, particularly a white person, accused of killing a person of color. So what that says is, again, I've said that the death penalty is a real indictment of our society. What that says is that we as a society tend to put a much higher value on white lives than we do the lives of color. Now, most people would say, of course, I'm not racist. But in fact, it does happen in courts. Often we are racist and are not aware of it. It's a very subtle thing sometimes. And for example, a person on a jury may not give as much weight to a witness who's a person of color compared to a witness who's white. We would be more suspicious of a person of color who's a defendant than a white person.
Earlier this year, the American Bar Association called for a moratorium on executions, a decision Bryan commends.
This country should not be in the business of executing as long as racism, color affects a verdict, as long as the size of one's bank account affects a verdict, right. The quality of representation, as long as we make mistakes and innocent people get executed. And there's no way to remove... that's not going to happen. Those things are going to continue to occur in our society. And the answer obviously is, and it's wrong to the thought of executing even one innocent person. It's
right.
Horrible.
Yes,
that's too high a price to pay to be in the business of executing.
Supporters of the death penalty say that executions serve to deter future criminals from committing acts of violence. They also say that victims' families deserve some sort of resolution and final justice. Some proponents also believe that executions are more cost-effective than life sentences, although numerous studies show that executions can sometimes be up to 3 times more expensive, in part due to the often long legal process most death penalty cases go through. That's why some pro-death penalty politicians are calling for a limit to the number of appeals death row inmates can file. Again, Robert Bryan.
I often think of the death penalty as being political, and it is. It's the politics of death. The death penalty has become a very good vehicle for our politicians to get votes, to be elected. If one wants to get votes, stimulate people to go to the polls and vote for them on election day, all that person has to do is hit the emotional buttons of the public. Talk about crime, this easy fix, the death penalty, which is not a fix. People are frustrated because of crime, and they think, well, he or she is doing something about crime. This is a way to fix this problem, and it does not fix it at all. It compounds the problem. If we want to do something about crime in this country, we should do something about poverty. We should do something about people not being able to get a decent education. We should do something about, I think of many mothers who have to support children by themselves, have no financial aid or very little. It's very rough. It's very difficult. If you want to do something about crime, do something about child abuse.
Across the United States, recovering from aggressive policing in their communities, find one another and organize for action, they're discovering that they have a lot in common with families in other parts of the world. Zenaida Velasquez of Honduras has been...